select play in guiding us towards a love and belief in a creator. Does our intellect prove conclusively that we have a creator? Does it hold us back? Does it kind of do both things, sometimes make us inclined towards a belief in God, and at other times make us doubt? What is the role of our mind, our intellect, our rationality in our faith in God? And you don't need to answer that as a philosopher, but answer it for each and every one of you. I assume that each and every one of you has thought about whether and why one should believe in God. And how have you answered that question to yourself? I want to use that as a lead-in to the points that we want to cover in this afternoon session, inshallah. Does anybody have any thoughts the elder members of our community may have had, more years where they've spent thinking about that question, may have additional insight, and the rest of you also may have some insight or some questions that you would like to bring to the table?
I'll start.
I think intellect is essential. Things are not around us by coincidence. Coincidences are highly unlikely. It happens once here or there. But everything that surrounds me is structured, and it is beyond anything I can imagine. That takes me to the creation. So we can't deal with things by instinct. And that's why the Quran and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala distinguishes from animals, because of the intellect we have. So yes, intellect is the basis, and the touch of instinct, and the touch of biases. You start with being biased. I mean, I was born Muslim, so that is a step. But now you need the intellect to support you. And you will enjoy it by using the intellect. You don't want to be just like a sheep, just moving behind the imam, and that's it.
You couldn't have said it better if we had coordinated ahead of time to have you give that answer. We didn't
coordinate this morning.
But in any case, I think that is the reason why many people do believe in God. Many of us, perhaps, sometimes loosely known as the argument from design. The world doesn't seem like a coincidence. It doesn't really make sense for everything to exist as it does, purely by coincidence. Does anybody disagree with that? Or does anybody have a question about whether that's true? Please.
I do not disagree with that. But there was an incident. I mean, you say about intellect. Sometimes intellect, you take it like, oh, he's PhD or something. Yeah. Intellect means just having a mind, or having an open mind. So when they asked this lady in the desert, كَيْفَ عَرَفْتِ اللَّهِ, how do you know that there is a God? She said that الْأَثَرُ يَدُلُّ عَلَى الْمَسِيرِ وَالْبَعْرَةُ تَدُلُّ عَلَى الْبَعِيرِ, which means that in her environment, she has only sheep, and she had sand. And she sees footprints, and she said, there must be somebody has stepped here before. Otherwise, how do we have this footsteps? And the same thing for the stool of the animal, for the dropping of the animals. There's a dropping there. It means that there was something there. And then she said, so do you believe, do you want me to believe that the whole thing here, the whole kaun, the whole universe, does not have somebody who made it? So yes, I agree with that, but I just want to comment that intellect does not mean that I have to have a PhD. I have to have just an open mind to think.
That's a very good point. Yes, certainly the mind is different from education. There are people who are educated beyond their intellect, and therefore they have degrees which their mind and their ability to think do not support. And then there are people who don't have that education, but they have very active minds. So with that comment, does anybody have any questions about the different phrasing of, again, the argument from design? That what we see, But we observe it couldn't have existed without a creator. Just as a footprint in the desert or an animal print in the desert can't exist without an animal having traversed that path. Is there any further thought that is required about, at the very least, this argument, or can we take it just at that level? Is our sister's hand up and then the brother's?
Assalamualaikum, first of all. Are we taking intellect right now as purely reasoning, like the human rationale?
At this point, let's take it purely in the sense of your ability to reason, to analyze, and to prove things.
Because I've heard from a lot of people, even like devout Muslims, that you cannot come to the conclusion that there is a God purely from reason. Now, I don't have an answer to this question, like I'm not taking one side or the other. And I've also been, I've heard from scholars that it's wrong to come to the conclusion that there is a God purely from scientific evidence, drawing scientific parallels between the world and the Quran and things like, embryology or whatever else. Like, it's wrong to derive your belief from God purely from that, scientific parallels, because science is like a description of the physical world. Like, even the argument of design, how everything is like kind of coincidental. It couldn't have been a coincidence how everything is set up. That's still just a very physical understanding of the world and of ourselves. And it's wrong to derive... So what I'm saying is it's wrong to derive the existence of God, the belief of God, purely from physical parallels, but also that you cannot come to the realization of God purely based on rationale.
Well, you've said it's two different things.
Yeah.
Which are not contradictory, but they're two separate
ideas. Yeah.
One is that if you want to believe in God, you shouldn't go about it purely by looking at deducing something using your intellect. The other is that you should not interpret the Quran or understand Islam. If I had now understood you correctly, and this might only be a part of what you were indicating, through purely physical means or empirical means. The second point, although it's not directly related to our topic, is one of the things that we do want to understand, and so I will build upon it with your permission for a moment, and then we can set it aside for now. It is a common custom among many in the Muslim community. Those of you who are in college or who were in college in the last 2 years, you've probably heard of the writings of people like Harun Yahya and many other writers within the Muslim world who do use the recent discoveries in different fields of science to justify and to prove the Quranic revelation. A major problem with that is that it subordinates our faith in the Quran or our faith in Islam to the latest discovery. And that, in principle, is something which is dangerous. Because if an Islamic law or if a theory which seems to currently support a particular Quranic verse is modified or changed in the future, then if our practice of the Sharia, or our practice or our faith in Islamic law, or our faith in the Quran is based on the affirmation of those scientific theories, it will also be shaken as those theories may change or may develop in the future. And that is not the way in which our faith was ever intended to be formed or strengthened. In effect, that would be saying that Allah had kind of revealed the Quran and revealed these words not for the people who were addressed by those words and not for many centuries and the majority of people who would read those words, but only for a few people in the future who would have the benefit of recent discoveries, say, in embryology or in geology or in astronomy and so on and so forth. And certainly that is not the case. That's a very valid point. That is something that we will touch upon tangentially, but it was good that it was brought up. The first point is something that I would like to get some more insight in. That is a key question related to the very essence of our topic. Should we use our faith? Should we use our reason in order to derive our faith? What should we think of, for example, the argument from design? If somebody says that I believe in God, because I don't think that everything could be a coincidence. We have all of these different realities within the universe and within the world. And if the orbit of the Earth around the Sun and the distance of the Earth from the Sun and the angling of our orbit with respect to the rotation of the Earth were slightly different, and if many astronomical constants were even slightly different, then we would not exist and life would not exist, and all of this cannot be a coincidence, whether we talk about these discoveries that have come in recent times, or whether we talk about general aspects of creation that were observable even to people at the time of the Prophet and in previous generations. Is that a good argument? Is that a good basis for our faith? Or is it deficient? And if you were saying that it is deficient based on at least some of the things that you've heard and you seem to give some credits to, why would it be deficient? Or is it not just deficient, but wrong-headed? That is the question that I would like us to explore. I think I saw your hand up from before, and then we can continue.
Yes, so I think there are some very interesting points here, and I think with using logic alone or reason alone to try to prove this point, it is difficult because reason is also used by people who disbelieve in Islam, or even people who are very familiar with Islam. Will you try to use reason to find faults or reasons to disbelieve in the religion and in Allah? So when reason alone is used, it can go either way. And when the very nice example of the footprint left by an animal shows you that there's an animal there, at the same time, the kind of mentality that I've seen is that people will say, well, you can't really prove that an animal is there. You can infer that an animal is there. So you need something beyond what we might consider evidence. You need faith. So when we see a footprint of an animal, we see a footprint, and in order to make the conclusion that there's an animal, we have faith to believe that there's an animal. So that alone is not evidence that there's an animal, but we complete it by having that faith. So logic alone, you can always have that doubt, and always create a chance that just by random nature moving of the wind and the sand, something like the shape of a footprint came into existence. And that's the sort of logic that is used because they don't have that faith.
It's a very important point. And the relationship of faith or iman to logic is one of the things that I want us to think about during this session. Christians, well, what you said right now could be interpreted in one of several ways. So I'm not going to try to impose upon your words a particular reading. But one thing that Christians will often say is that faith is something that is beyond reason and that is a mystery. And if you could explain it, it wouldn't be faith. I'm not saying that's what you said. But the question we want to ask is, what is the relationship of our logic to our faith? Our reasoning and our logic, is it going to lead us up to a point where then we have to take a leap of faith? We have a mystery, and we have to say that I'm going to believe without understanding and without having a rational basis, an intellectual basis, a logical basis for faith? Or is that not the case? If it is the case, then where is the faith coming from? If it is not the case, then what is the relationship between that logic and our faith? Even if people, as you said, do use that same reason and that same logic to disprove religion and disprove the existence of God. Let me give a specific example right now. What is the probability if I flip a coin of getting a heads versus a tail? 50%. What is the probability of doing it twice?
25.
Do it twice in a row. So getting a heads and then getting a heads again.
Almost
50. 50.
No, it's
25%. 25%. Right? And then every time it will be one half of whatever it was before. So the third time will be 12.5% or 1/8, and the next time it'll be 1/16, and so on and so forth. And if you do it 100 times in a row, it's going to be very, very low. Right?
I have to disagree. Really. Every time you flip the coin, you have to treat it separately. Every time you flip it, your chances are 50%.
Well, that's what we're going to get to right now. And that is one of the objections which is made to, for example, the argument from design, which is in one form or another, probably the closest that any of us can usually get to using our mind to approach belief in God. If we start from the beginning, right, and we say, what is the probability of getting two heads in a row? We can't take each independently, because I have to get one head. That's already half of the times that I roll. And then out of that half, it's going to be half of those times where the second time will also be a heads. Right? Basic probability says that then it's not independent, it'll be 1/4. For the third time and then the fourth time, all the way up to 100, we'll get progressively smaller, and it will be an exceedingly rare event to get 100 heads in a row. But I think what you are saying, which is a valid point, is that if you've rolled 100 heads in a row, what is the probability that you will have a heads for the next roll, the 101st roll? 50%. It's not exceedingly low anymore, because you've already rolled 100 times. It's one of a very rare event for you to get to this point, where you've rolled 100 heads in a row. Right? We're not having, you know, a stacked deck, and it's not a weighted coin. It was a fair toss, and it was very unlikely for you to get to this point. But given that you've rolled 100 heads in a row, the probability that you'll roll 101 heads is 50%, and the probability that you'll have 100 heads followed by a tails is also 50%. At this point, it is 50%. And once you've rolled 101 heads in a row, what is the probability of it being a heads? No, of having rolled 101 heads in a row. It's full. Right? That is what you've done. Once it's taken place, there is no other probability. It's 100% because you've already done it. And so when people say, for example, that we've had three boys in a row and one and a half a daughter, and it's really unlikely that we would have four kids in a row and all of them would be boys, and so it's a better than likely chance that we'll have a girl, that's wrong. Why is it wrong? Because every birth has an equal chance of being a boy or a girl. For people who have already had three boys, half of them will have, if they have a fourth child, a boy, and half of them will have a girl, approximately. If you're looking at it before you've had any children, then you're looking at a different question. And you can say, what is the probability of having four boys in a row? It's exceedingly rare. But once you've had three boys in a row, what is the probability of the next child being a boy or a girl? It's a different question, and that is 50%. So now, with that reminder for those of us who may have studied statistics a long time ago and forgot about it as a college course, the objection that is made to the argument from design is, how do we know how many universes there were? There might have been millions and billions and untold numbers of universes where we didn't have this distance between the earth and the sun. Right? The porridge was too hot, the porridge was too cold, in billions of universes, and it was in this universe that the porridge was just right. And when it comes to the seasons, when it comes to all of our other biological and astronomical realities, they just happen to be this way in this universe. We are speaking about it after having rolled the dice 101 times. And so it is the way it is. We're not speaking about it before the universe is created, for us to say, well, what is the chance at each time that it is going to be a hex, right? That it will be the right constant for us to have people with intelligence who can sit here and say, did we come by chance, or were we created? The question is clear, or the objection is clear. Sister, I think you had your hand up to say something. Did you have your hand up? So what I'm speaking of is, for example, we say that if the Earth were further away from the Sun, then it wouldn't get warm enough for us to have life. If the Earth were too close to the Sun, then it would be too hot for us to have life. If the Earth rotated without the axis of rotation being on a different plane than the axis of the orbit of the Earth around the Sun, we wouldn't have seasons. And we wouldn't be able to have the same life on Earth as we have now. We wouldn't have human beings. If gravity didn't exist as it did, if other realities within the universe didn't exist as they did, then those realities, that's what I meant by principles, those, if they didn't exist in exactly that form, we wouldn't be here. So that would indicate to many of us, and it does indicate to many of us, that there was a design involved. That somebody designed it perfectly, so that if it had been designed any other way, we wouldn't be here to talk about it. The objection that is made is, well, you happen to be talking about it because maybe Allah rolled, you know, chance rolled billions and billions of coins like that or dice, and this is the one that happened to work out where everything was perfect. Or, to use the example of the footprints, this is the one universe where the wind happened to blow just so that you got footprints without there ever having been an animal. This is the one universe where somebody threw up a bunch of Scrabble pieces and it came down and it exactly worded a Shakespearean play. Right? If you do it enough times, trillions and trillions of times, right? All of them but one will give you some kind of gibberish, but if you do it enough times, you might get a Shakespearean play. Once that has happened, how do you know how many other times there were? So does that just undo the argument from designer? Is everybody who believed in God for one of those reasons now a fool? They weren't sophisticated enough, they weren't right enough, they didn't know it, they thought they knew it? Where does that leave us? That this is what I wanted us to use as an introduction now to.
If we follow that argument, that would also extrapolate into our everyday lives. That does not happen to us. Nothing, when we live our lives, we don't live it by chance. So that does not align with our intellect. All our thoughts, our processes, our actions are deliberate. And there's just, if things happen by design, it would also be how our behavior would be. That we would extrapolate it and say, okay, I can take 50% chance of a coin toss. The actions that we take, let's say I have a test tomorrow, or presentation, or a client, or whatever, 50% chance I'm going to do well. So we don't behave like that. So that does not align with what our intellect tells us with the design argument.
So, what you are saying is that this objection is not a valid objection.
What I'm saying is our intellect, if you use that as a measure of using whether design is right or creation is right, does not align with the design argument. Because we don't live our life by chance. We live it in a very deliberate manner. And when we don't live it in a deliberate manner, we make mistakes and then we have repercussions.
So we live our life in a deliberate manner, which means that our intellect does not align with the argument from design, or it doesn't align with the objection to the argument from design.
It
doesn't allow us to believe that everything is by chance, or it doesn't allow us to prove that it exists by purpose.
Okay, it does not allow with the argument with the design. What I'm saying is, our intellect, how we live our lives, is not aligned with the design argument. For design. It's against the design, is what I'm saying.
So think about, I'm not quite following what you are saying. I thought I was following your train of thought earlier. But maybe we'll come back to you in just a moment, if you might want to explain it a bit more clearly, or if somebody else has understood it and would be able to explain it to me.
Your sister had some questions.
Sure.
Yes. I just had a quick question. When you said intellect, in Islamic terminology, are you using the word ilm, or is it aql, or is it qalb? What is the terminology?
Well, we'll come to that. I don't want to speak of Arabic terminology or Islamic terminology right now, because generally, when we approach the ahadith, when we approach the Qur'an, and when we approach Islamic, the history of Islamic sciences, those terms have developed and been used in a certain way. There's different definitions of aql, there's different definitions of ilm, and so right now I want to look at it from where we are starting by using the language of our discourse in English. And then we'll try to understand, at least in the Qur'an, if not the length of Islamic disciplines, what we should understand as the source of our knowledge of God. Right? Now, our concern in this session is not to understand Islamic philosophy or the philosophy of the Islamic tradition and the definitions of aql or the definitions of ilm that have been used in philosophical texts or in theological texts. Our concern right now is going to be twofold. Number one is this issue of why do we believe in God and the role of our intellect and our faith? And number two, which is also a very important question, how are we going to acquire religious knowledge? Especially if we believe that the source of religious knowledge must be an authentic and an infallible source, a ma'asum. How are we going to derive religious knowledge? Because you and I can't just dial up a ma'asum and get that knowledge. So what is going to be the source of our religious knowledge? Those are the two questions that I want us to focus on. And they are directly of concern for us to understand our religious knowledge. Not in a universal sense of what are the different meanings of ilm that have been used by different schools of thought within Islamic theology or philosophy. So we will come to that. But to come back to this question now, does our intellect comport with, is it harmonious with the argument from design? Or does it move us away from that argument from design in any of its forms that we have heard earlier? You as individuals, do you buy the argument from design, or does that not have any role to play in your own faith?
The assumption with that is that time is infinite, though, in the sense that there can be like a trillion of worlds of the dice, and we don't actually know what the time is.
Yeah, the assumption is that there could have been an infinite number, virtually infinite number of rolls of the dice, and this one happened to be accurate. We don't know that is the case. We don't know it's not the case. Why, if we want to believe the argument from design in one of its forms, we want to say that's not the case, and this universe was designed by a creator. Why should we believe that? Or should we not? Should we say, scratch that? That's not an argument. That's not a valid argument.
It should be a package You cannot dissect it. You can't take logic by itself. That could be devastating. You can't take statistics by itself. That could be devastating. It's just like a chemical reaction. You take one element, it might poison you. You put it with another element, it would be very healthy. So we have to take intellect as a package, as a comprehensive matter. So if we sit and dissect it, then it will take us too far from there.
So we're looking at now taking intellect as a package. That is an important point. Look at that in light of a few verses of the Quran as well. What does that mean? In other words, is the argument from design, this is my question to you. Now, is the argument from design something that we're going to put away and say, no, we're not using this, this is wrong, this is not going to lead to result in belief in God? Or are we saying that if you have the proper package, then no, this argument is a good argument? And if so, what is that package? Right? Those are two choices. You might come up with a third option. And brother, if you'd like to maybe also clarify what you were saying earlier, which I apologize for not quite understanding what your intention was, then which of these two choices or another choice would you like to present? Let's maybe have two or three more comments and then we can move on. Sure.
So yeah, yesterday you were talking about the biblical identity. Also, last one. I didn't get the last one.
The problems with modern secular culture. Well, yesterday I talked about four things: materialism, individualism, rationality, and state institutions. Rationality is one of the things now that we're talking about specifically in this session. And the question is, specifically the argument from design, which in my mind is the main argument that people use when they think about proving God's existence, right? The heavens and the earth. And where can we place that? Is there a package that makes that argument a valid argument, or is there not a package?
I think so. It's more than just throwing scrapbook pieces in there. Who is throwing scrapbook pieces? Where did scrapbook pieces come from? The creation of the earth, the design, isn't simply two things that basically crashed into each other and happened. Where did those elements come from? It's not as simple as, it's not the general idea, it's the pieces of it that come together. Personally, for me, I don't think chance could be possible, chance, but there's a power behind that chance. There's a force behind that chance. There's something that drives that chance. And if we don't know what drives it, if we don't know what comes to it, I don't know how we can dismiss this argument.
All right. Am I now ready to take the next step? Okay, we can have one more comment from the brother, and then we can move discussion forward in trouble. Thank you for all of your thoughts and for all of your comments. I think that now we've heard enough to take one step forward. The key issue that has caused many people, many philosophers, many thinkers, this group of people that are known as the New Atheists, and have written bestseller books and so on, one issue that has caused a lot of people to be willing to say that there's no proof for the existence of God is this idea that chance can give the same results as what other people think is design. So they say, for example, that evolution gives the illusion of design without there being design or intent involved. And so when people speak of evolution, they will speak using the language that an engineer or that a designer would use. That they will say that that's just the illusion of design, it's not really design. And I think what when you mentioned that we need to look at a package deal, or when the sister says that we are not just looking at Scrabble pieces, but where did those Scrabble pieces come from in the first place, what you are alluding to is related to the question of the relationship of logic and faith. And this is that throughout our life, we have a determination or a decision to make about causality. And that is something that is intuitive. It's not something that you can demonstrate or that you can prove. But the intuition is not a blind intuition. You observe a correlation between different things, and you see that there must be, or there likely is, a causal relationship between them. And then you use your observations and your experience and your power of thinking to intuit causality. In some cases, you may think there is causality where there is merely correlation. In some cases, you may observe a correlation between two things and think that one is the cause of the other or vice versa, but they are both the effect of a third thing, or the causality might be in the reverse order of what you thought. You thought A was the cause of B, but it actually is the case that B is the cause of A, or A and B are both the effect of a cause C, for example. They always come together, but not because they are the cause of one another. But that determination is something which is not subject purely to logic. It comes from a determination based on your logic and your prior experience and your sensual observations, and it is a determination that your mind and your soul will make, that there is a cause or there is not a cause. The faith is not a mystery that comes by leaving your logic and your rationality at one point and saying, now we have to move beyond it to something that is unsupported by logic or by our intellect. It's not a leap in the dark. But what it is a decision based upon that logic and based upon every other faculty within your soul and within your being. Okay? The difference is that when you make the decision to believe in a cause, whether it be a cause for the universe as a whole, where did all those gravel pieces come from, or whether it be the cause of an individual thing, that is not a blind leap of faith, unlike what you might hear from Christian theology, but it is a decision, and that decision is supported by your observations, and by your logic, and by every other faculty of your soul. The important point, though, is that it is a decision. And that is why you can't limit yourself simply to the logic. I think that is what some of you may have been saying when you said that you need to have a look at the entire package and not just the reason. Right? Now, why will you make that determination? Let's look at a few verses of the Quran. And this will give us a little bit of a better idea of where our religious knowledge, inshallah, is to derive from. The first verse I want to look at very briefly, and so I'll give you the verse number, Surah An-Nahl, verse number 78. You can look at the translation of the tafsir and the context of the preceding and the following verses, inshallah, on your own. The context of this verse is where Allah talks about different blessings and different favors that he has bestowed upon humanity, and he wants people to use those blessings and those different ni'mas as a source for affirmation that Allah is their creator and their Lord and their sustainer. The verse says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَاللَّهُ أَخْرَجَكُمْ مِنْ بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا. Allah took you out of your mother's wombs in such a state that you didn't know anything. وَجَعْلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْبَصَرَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. And God gave you hearing, and He gave you the power of sight, and He gave you hearts. Perhaps it is that you will show gratitude. So Allah says that you were born without knowledge, without knowing anything. Now, Mufassirin have a slight difference about exactly what it means not to have known anything when you were born. At the very least, it means we didn't have acquired knowledge. We may have had a certain knowledge by presence, a knowledge that we exist, right? Things which are inseparable from our very being, because you can't not know that you're hungry. Your being and your soul has that hunger present within it. You can't not know that you exist, because that's present within you. But at the very least, we didn't have acquired knowledge. And that comes then from several sources. Our senses, right, our empirical knowledge, which in the Qur'an are exemplified by two of our most important senses. It's not saying that only our sam and our basar, only our hearing and our seeing are the source of our empirical knowledge or our sensual knowledge. But those are two of our most important senses. That's how we learn a great deal about the broader world. We hear about it or we see it. And then there are some things that we touch and some things that we smell and some things that we taste. But largely it is these two senses, with the help of our other senses, والأفئدة. And then we have a heart. Now, that heart is, yes, the mind, but also the intuition, also the emotion, also the feeling within ourself. It's something creational, it's something existential, and it is deeper than simply what we think. And it is what we think, and what we feel, and what we can swear upon, even if we can't explain it. All of that is part of our fu'ad, or our af'ida, as the verse says. And Allah says that it is these things that are going to be the source now of your gaining information, which is acquired knowledge, knowledge that you acquire about the world. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. The reason why Allah did this is that perhaps you will show gratitude to Him. So this is going to have a role in our developing knowledge of God and a ability to worship God, because worship in its essence is gratitude to our Creator. That's one verse, Surah Al-Nahl, verse number 78. The other verse I want to look at is the verse of Surah Al-A'raf, is verse number 172, which is known as Ayatul Mithaq. Right, the verse where Allah took a mithaq, a covenant, from every human being. I'll read the verse, I'll briefly indicate some of the points of the tafsir of this verse that have been mentioned by Mufassirin, and then I want to get to a few important lessons that we can derive from it in terms of understanding what our religious knowledge is and where it comes from. The verse is, again, it's Surah Al-A'raf, which is Surah number 7, verse number 172. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, وَإِذْ أَخَذَ رَبُّكَ مِنْ بَنِي آدَمَ مِنْ ظُهُورِهِمْ ذُرِّيَّتَهُمْ أَشْهَدَهُمْ عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِهِمْ أَلَسْتُ بِرَبِّكُمْ قَالُوا بَلَىٰ شَهِدْنَا أَن تَقُولُوا يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ إِنَّا كُنَّا عَنْ هَذَا غَافِلِينَ. Allah says that when your Lord took from the children of Adam, from their loins, their progeny, He made them witnesses over themselves. Am I not your Lord? They said, verily, we testify that you are our Lord. And Allah says the reason why He took this covenant from each and every human being is so that no one says on the day of judgment, Yawm al-Qiyamah, that we didn't know about this. Or that people will not say that their parents were mushrik and they followed their parents in unbelief. It's the continuation of that verse in the Quran. Now the question which Mufassirin have asked is, what does this mithaq refer to? When did God take this covenant? And we certainly didn't exist, at least in our current form, in the time of Adam. I don't remember this mithaq being taken. I don't know if any of you remember it being taken. Perhaps some of you have a memory that extends further back than my own. But Mufassirin have claimed that people do not remember this mithaq, so it wasn't a conscious event. Or if it was a conscious event and then we forgot about it, what relevance does it have for us? What does it mean then? How can it mean that God will use this on the day of judgment to say that you should have had faith? And then how will he say to us that you can't pray that you didn't know because I took a covenant? The first thing that comes to our mind is that we'll say, God, I don't remember that covenant. You must have done it when we were sleepy, when we were groggy, before our soul was fully developed, at the very least. So it doesn't have any kind of a proof. There is one group of Mufassirin that has said this refers to something known as Alam al-Dhab, which is when people existed in some kind of form of particles or atoms, and every human being in that primitive form of physical existence was present and was made a witness over their own creation and their need of Allah, and then everybody attested to Allah being their Lord and their Creator, and then they were brought into existence over time, over their generations. So that is one tafsir that exists. Another tafsir is that this doesn't refer to something that happened in prehistory or before our being born into this world, but it refers to our existential reality. When we were born, not at some time before we were created in our current bodies, not at some time before Adam was sent to this world, but when we were born in this life, our existence and our vulnerability and our need itself is an indication that we have the need of a creator. And our being, by its very reality, admits that we have a creator. That's one tafsir. Or, when we speak of our vulnerability, when we speak of our limitations, when we speak of being subject to the rules of God or even to the rules of nature, what we are in effect saying, by extension, is that we are subject to the laws of the creator of that world. So these are two other commentaries which exist. That either our existence by its very reality, our vulnerability, our poverty, that indicates that we have a creator, or our words, where we express our vulnerability, those words, by extension, indicate that we have a creator. That's another tafsir. And then a third tafsir is, this is the tafsir which is supported by Allama Tabatabai, Tafsir al-Mizan, that there is a higher level of creation. Creation has one aspect where Allah puts something in the world, and then creation has one aspect which is not from the created thing and its development in this world, but the attribution of that thing that is created to Allah. And this relationship of the created thing to Allah, it has a higher realm in Malakut, a celestial existence, which is not subject or limited to the graduated movement of the physical world. Our soul, everything that exists within the world, when it is created by Allah, Allah knows from the moment of creation exactly what different stages and processes and changes that created thing is going to go through. If you look at the created thing and its existence within the world, it is growing, it is changing in magnificent ways and sometimes in unpredictable ways. But if you look at the attribution of that thing to Allah, it's not changing, it's not unpredictable. It was all there in Allah's knowledge and in His power and in His wisdom from the moment of creation. And so that realm is Malakut. And in that realm, there is no curtain and there is no separation between God and His creation. The attribution of a created thing to God Himself. And on that level, which exists within everything that is there within the world, not just people, even stones, even trees, as the Quran says, that everything does tasbih, everything glorifies Allah, but we don't understand the tasbih. Everything has a higher reality when Allah creates it, that it recognizes its creator, it knows its Lord. This is what the verse is speaking of. Not before our existence. Not just the reality of our existence in the physical world. But that higher reality that still has an uncurtained, an unveiled relationship to Allah. On that level, we all actually have witnessed that we have been created by Allah. And there is no will and there is no ability for us to reject it. And now, these are different possibilities in tafsir. I've introduced them to you and you can look at them in more detail. The next step is when we look at different ahadith from Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam, what they say is that if it had not been for this kitab, if it had not been for this covenant, then nobody would be able to know his or her Lord. So whatever the proper tafsir is, and I've given you an indication of some of the possibilities that have been mentioned by Mufassirin, it is this uncurtained, unveiled witnessing of God's creation that is the basis and the source for each and every one of us to know Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And so, when Allah created us in this world, He created us to know Him. And all of the faculties that He gave us are leading us towards Him. So to answer the question that we have been exploring until now, our reasoning and our intellect are never going to take us away from Allah. But they might not be able to bring us all the way to conclusively affirm that God is our Creator, because they need to be part of a package. We need to be able to also ask that question that, well, where would all of the parts have come from? For us then to say, did these parts come together by chance, or did they come together by design? Where are the parts from in the first place? Right? That package that is guided by the fact that in our creation, Allah has shown us our vulnerability and our relationship to Him without any curtains, without any veils, without any barrier or any obstacle. Now, remember that the verse says, and again it is in Surah Al-A'raf, verse number 172, if you would like to go and look at the commentaries and ponder the verse some more, أَشْهَدَهُمْ عَلَىٰ أَنْفُسِهِمْ. Allah did not let us see God. We can't see God. It's not that in that state or in that higher realm we've seen God, as some false schools of thought within Islam have mistakenly believed or believe not. أَشْهَدَهُمْ عَلَىٰ أَنْفُسِهِمْ. God showed us our own reality without any curtains, without any veils. And when we see our own reality at that higher realm without any curtains, not that we've seen God, but when we see ourselves and all of our faculties that we have been created with, that's enough for us to answer the question, أَلَسْتُ بِرَبِّكُمْ. When God asks us, am I not your Lord? قَالُوا بَلَىٰ شَهِدْنَا. Every human soul, every human being, not just the parents, not just the earlier generations, not just Adam alayhi salam, but each and every individual human being at that higher level witnesses that yes, you are our Creator. And so the source of unbelief or the reason why people have sometimes a lack of belief in God is because they have taken one part of that and thought that that is going to be the only basis of their understanding of creator, of their creator. If you look at atheists, many of them, the reason for their atheism is because they say that we're only going to believe in things that we can empirically demonstrate. But are you just a human being who lives your life on the basis of what you can empirically understand? You don't have a sense of right and wrong. You don't have a sense of perfection and a sense of beauty. You don't decide causality about everything that exists within your life. That causality that you decide for everything else is not empirical. Why, when it comes to the causality of the universe, are you going to limit yourself to just what you can empirically understand? So that is something that we can perhaps end at this point. I'll give an opportunity if there's any questions that you want to do to conclude this portion of the session. But in light of these verses of the Quran, we can gain a greater understanding, a deeper understanding of where the source of our faith in God is to be and how we can strengthen that faith. And sometimes these obstacles or these objections that come into people's mind, it is because they have the wrong understanding of where our faith was to come from in the first place. If we think that our faith is to be a leap in the dark, a mystery that we cannot explain, that is not going to be a meaningful faith, because our intellect was given to us to lead us towards God. But if we think that our intellect, in the sense of our power of logic and reasoning alone, is going to be the limit of what we can understand of God, then we're not going to be able to derive a proper understanding of God. We might become a deist, we might not even become a deist, but we won't have a belief in a God whom we know and whom we worship and whom we supplicate towards. And I think that is probably what you were indicating earlier when you said that it's a deficient God if our faith is only going to be through our intellect. So I do want to move on to another point, and I know we're limited in time, but if there's any comments or any questions up to this point and in light of these verses, we can take a few moments to deal with them.
So are you saying that we can't use just our intellect to reach God? We need the fitra, or
what I'm saying is that the intellect will awaken and inform us of what is within our fitra. Our intellect, divorced from our fitra, is a deficient tool.
So basically, we need the fitra alongside the intellect to lead us.
Yes, we do need our fitra, and all the fitra basically is the way in which God created us. It includes our intellect, and it includes all of the faculties of our soul. So it's not this or that, but it is that our intellect is part of our creation. And so if we are going to look only at our power of reasoning, we might not be able to, our power of reasoning may not be strong enough to lead us to God. We might get confused in those kinds of objections because we lose sight of the forest, but for the trees. And if we use our reasoning, the picture of God that we will get may be a theoretical and a very analytical deity, but not the deity that is going to be an object of love and veneration and adoration and dua and supplication. So the point is that our intellect is part of what is going to lead us to God. It's never going to properly deploy. It's never going to mislead us. It's not going to take us to a point saying, well, from here on out, we just have to use some other faculty because it's a leap of faith. No, our intellect was given to us to lead us to God, but it's part of what's going to lead us to God, not the entire thing. To have a proper worship of God, we need all of the faculties of our creation, one of which is our power of reasoning. Right? That's part of our fu'ad, of our heart. Not all of it. So, one more question, and inshallah we'll move on.
I was wondering if you could provide a quick definition of logic. You just mentioned that we use logic in addition to our observations. My impression was that logic, it was ultimately based on, you need your observations and then you use logic to make understand what you observe. But I was wondering if there's also this another form of logic that you don't actually have to observe something to logically come to a logical conclusion about an issue.
What we're referring to right now is the reasoning and the analytical mind, which tries to reason from what it knows to what it doesn't know. That reasoning, if it is developed in a person, it will be able to give certain conclusions which an undeveloped reasoning might not be able to give. And so the logic that can be deployed by a developed soul is very different from the logic that can be deployed and that can be used by an uneducated or an undeveloped soul. And education is different from a developed soul. So that's not really a question of what type or what level of logic we are referring to, but that faculty of deduction and analysis as a whole, in different people, at different levels, is part of the equation of what's going to lead us to God. And in light of these Quranic verses, and it's a very interesting, both of these verses are interesting, especially the second verse, Ayatul Nithaq, the verse of Surah Al-A'raf 172, there's a lot of literature that's been written about it, very interesting. Discussing both Islamic philosophy, theology, and ahadith, and so it's something that is certainly valuable to explore. But I want to move on now. Once we have a bit of an understanding of where our belief in God itself, which is the basis of our religious knowledge, is to come from, and what the nature of that knowledge is, the second key question is, does our present time allow us to acquire authentic religious knowledge, or is Shiism on hold right now? Let me ask that question in a different way. A lot of Sunnis will say, some of you may have had discussions and arguments with Sunni friends, for example, they will say that, your Shia emphasis on religious knowledge, authentic knowledge, the need of a ma'asum, that's all well and good when you had 11 imams. But now, where is your imam? We go to our mufti, you go to your mufti. We go to our faqih, you go to your faqih. Our faqih guesses in Islamic law, your faqih guesses in Islamic law. Alright, you'll say that you have more ahadith. You'll say that your faqih has a better process of ijtihad. We'll say that our faqih has a better process of ijtihad. But in the end, it's a guess. So now, this is a different question, right? But what is the nature of our religious knowledge, and how can we acquire religious knowledge in our time? And does isma, or the knowledge of the imam, have any relevance to us? Or are we, in effect, just like Sunnis? What is the difference that maybe we have a few more ahadith, a few more specific answers that we can find in our religious sources about questions of theology, questions of ethics, questions of law, which they don't have. Which is just a quantitative difference. They have 30 hadith, we have 50. Their tafsir, is based on two companions. We have a tafsir based on the teachings, for example, of 11 imams. Which is just a quantitative difference. Or is there a qualitative difference involved in our religious knowledge? And if there is a qualitative difference, what is the nature of that qualitative difference? Is the question clear or is the question unclear? For our religious knowledge, right now, you and me, assuming that we've moved past the first question, we believe in God. What is the relevance of our 11 imams 12 imams. I don't want to say 11 at this point, because 11 was the historical period of the imams who were present in their communities, but the belief is in 12 imams. What is the relevance of those 12 imams when our imam is not accessible to us? And in effect, we're getting all our religious answers through books. Like non-Shia are getting their religious answers through books. We're getting our religious guidance or fatwas through scholars, like they're getting their answers through scholars. Is it just a matter of a difference in quantity?
No, quality.
What is the difference?
The quality, actually.
The quality? So is it just that we have better hadith, better fatwas?
No.
Or is there something else as well?
Something else. It's the better background or the better...
It's the better historical... how can I say it? I mean, when you get the information, you get it from somebody, and somebody's going to get the information from somebody else. So, tanakul, I don't know in English what it means.
Contradictions, self-contradictions. So, yeah, in some cases, we do have better ahadith. Right? If you look at the ahadith, for example, that are believed by many Sunni schools, they say that if a woman is unmarried and pregnant, then you stone her unless she can prove that she wasn't guilty of a crime. Right? In our ahadith, we don't have that. Right? The fact that a woman is pregnant without marriage doesn't prove that she was guilty of a crime. It might be the case that a crime was committed against her and she could be a plaintiff and not need to be a defendant. So we have better sources, better ahadith, because they come from imams who are giving the rules of Allah. That is true. But is that it? Or is there also something else? Because that also is a historical thing. Like in this example, I certainly would not want to be a lady, you know, God forbid, who had been raped in a Maliki country. Because Imam Malik says that, well, unless you can prove that you were raped or that there was some mistake, say when you went to the hospital for a test, or there was something that was not your fault, unless you can prove it, then the assumption is that you've committed adultery or fornication and you're to be punished for it, according to whatever punishment is there. And that's a historical example. Right? I mention this example because it actually is part of the Hudud law in many countries that are trying to apply Sharia. And it's caused controversy and it's caused a big uproar and an objection to Sharia on the part of many countries. And of course, in Shia law, it wouldn't have even been a question or a controversy. It would have been able to be solved simply by looking at the hadith of our imams. But then there are places even within our hadith where the laws might not make sense. We might not be able to explain them. And so, what is the difference in those areas where it's not so clear how our ahadith are right, or we don't find an answer directly in our religious sources?
I think once we establish acceptance of the deen, certain things go with the territory, the Quran, and then the stage of the perfection of the religion during the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and then you have a conduit. And that conduit is a pipeline from the Prophet to the 11th Imam. The entire package was explained and processed. So it is a process. We base our knowledge on the process, not on the collective opinion.
And I think both of you have been saying something similar, and that's a valid point, that we have that conduit, we have that process. It's given us a very rich source of supplications, of law, of theology. It has solved a lot of problems that we find other schools of thought within Islam have not been able to solve, or if they've been able to solve it, they've had to solve it by becoming secular, not by being able, by sort of taking their religious heritage with a grain of salt. We've been able to solve it within our religious heritage. That is true. But then, what now for new problems?
Talk as an attendee, not as a moderator. The Divine Flash, there's a book where on Sayyid Tahran, it's the Divine Flash. The first tradition found in that book is, what is knowledge? Someone comes up to Imam Hussein and says, what is knowledge of God? He says, knowledge of your Imam. And when I look at Imam al-Tahrani, he describes the Imam. He puts the Imam in context of spirituality. And he says that, you know, the Imam, the 12th Imam, is directly linked to our whatever spiritual experience we have. So would the answer be found somewhere in that context?
Yes, the answer is found in the context of the 12th Imam being present within our life and within our guidance. So we are out of time. Can we take about 3 or 4 minutes to wrap up, or is it a hard conclusion that we have to end right now? 3 minutes? So I want to then, I won't ask the question, although it was my original intention. Again, it is my fault that the session started late, and I apologize for that. But I want to introduce one question that many of you may have perhaps come up with in your own lives. When we look at the lives of the Imams, when we look at the actions of, for example, Imam Hassan alayhi salam, right? Just one example. You sometimes see that the Imam has a poet who comes and praises Ahlul Bayt, praises the Imam, and the Imam gives that person, say, 50 dirhams or 500 dirhams. And you might wonder, is that being generous? Or maybe is there somebody who was more deserving, maybe a widow, maybe an orphan, than some poet who did, you know, something very generous? So there's incidents like that in the life of every Imam, where you see an incident, and sometimes it's very beautiful, sometimes it's very brave, sometimes it's very instructive, but then you wonder about how does that fit in with the rest of your life? Is it really a role model for you, or is it not? So even when it comes to the Imams of ourselves, in their own time when they're present, it's not the case that when the Imam gives a hadith, or when the Imam does something, we can always understand the implications and the extent of what the Imam is trying to accomplish. It's not just the case that now when the Imam is absent, all of a sudden we have a question, where we say, what's the difference between us and Sunnis? Because until now we said that we need an Imam who is ma'asum, and now we don't have access to that Imam who is ma'asum. Even when the Shia had access to the Imam who was ma'asum, the Imam would still provide answers, whether by words or by actions, that were in accordance with the limitations of the time and the place. And it may not always have been clear to even educated and scholarly listeners exactly what the Imam intended. Is that clear? So the solution is not that we need to solve the issue of ghaiba, because when the Imam is not present amongst us, then we have a special problem. The solution is that in the Shia school of thought, what we believe is that salvation in the hereafter and the perfection of human society, it comes through a connection to revelation and through divine guidance. When the Imam is present, our access to the Imam is limited by many factors, historical and social and political factors, which prevent the Imam from being able to fully share their knowledge, as Imam Ali has said, and as our other Imams have also said in their time, that if I were able to, I would give you such knowledge that would be able to answer many questions that I'm not able to express. So the Imams, even in their time, were not always able to express it. But whether the Imam is present or whether the Imam is not present, our belief is that our salvation and our success in this world and in the hereafter, it is going to come through humility, through an understanding of the limits of our own intellect and our own ability to find our answers, and then to turn to God in supplication to reveal through inspiration and direct guidance and through the Imam the next step. That principle is equally present in the time of hudur, presence of the Imam, and in the time of ghaiba, or the absence of the Imam. The difference between this belief and any other school of thought within Islam, any of the Sunni schools of thought, and even some of the Shia schools like the Zaydi school, at the very least the Sunni schools and some of the Zaydi schools, is that in their mind, that connection as a whole to revelation does not have any clear channel after the Prophet. There is no repository of divine guidance, of authentic knowledge, of isma, of infallibility after the Prophet. Some Zaydis may give some room for infallibility, and their Ismailis do give room for infallibility. The problem with them is that that infallibility sometimes goes against the Sharia itself, and that is not somebody who can be infallible. But if you look at the majority of Muslims in the world today, they believe that there is no need for infallibility, there is no place for infallibility. The difference between the Shia and the Sunni is not that we have access to the infallible knowledge of the Imam for us to wonder, well, what do we do in the time of Ghaybah? Even in the time of the Imam's presence, people would only be able to benefit from the Imam to the extent of their readiness and the Imam's willingness and readiness to convey knowledge, which was always much less than what the Imams possessed. In some ways, an Imam who is not limited by being physically present and having to wonder what some ignorant Shia might say and what some enemy might say, an Imam who is ghaib in that sense, actually has a freer hand, because those social limitations and those political limitations don't exist. But the difference is not about having access to the person of the Imam or not having access to the person of the Imam. The difference is believing that religious guidance and salvation comes from authentic knowledge and from humility before God in providing that knowledge in the form and at the time when He deems it ready. That belief is what tells us that we don't need our own intellect to take the place of what Isma did in the time of the Prophet. We don't need military force to take the place of Isma, to enforce what is right upon society. Allah always has a conclusive proof, a hujjah baligha, and there is always somebody who has the presence, I know that we're at the same time, who has the existence of that hujjah baligha. The deficiency is only a matter of whether we can access it or not. And that deficiency is not limited to the time of ghaybah. That deficiency exists even in the time of wudu. It is a matter of how ready I am to receive that guidance and how society as a whole is, how ready society as a whole is to receive that guidance. To the extent of the readiness, then just as a present Imam guides people, our present Imam, the Imam of our time, who is ghaib, who is not present amongst us, also is able to provide the guidance. But the difference is at that level of the source of religious knowledge and guidance. That our belief is that the purpose of humanity's creation in the dunya and in the akhirah, the world and in the hereafter, can only be accomplished by a connection to authentic knowledge, to perfect knowledge. And that is something which is a governing principle, a general principle. It's not affected by whether the Imam is in charge of the government or is not in charge of the government. Whether an Imam is present but in prison, or whether an Imam is free to teach. Either whether an Imam is present publicly in society or absent from society publicly. Right? That is a principle of our belief, that where religious guidance and salvation comes from is from authentic and infallible knowledge. So these are a few aspects of our belief in religious knowledge. We did have to truncate the conclusion of the session, inshallah. I will be present for a little bit after the salat if there are any questions or any comments about this last portion, but I wanted to include it because it's an important point for us to have discussed and to think about, and inshallah there will be other opportunities to explore the implications of that in greater detail. Thank you once again for your attention and for your patience, for all of us present, especially for the organizers of this conference and this opportunity to discuss important Islamic topics. Let us conclude with a salawatullah Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.